Support for WPR comes from the Madison Museum of Contemporary Art, an independent organization dedicated to creating experiences that educate, reflect, and inspire. More is at mmoca.org.
Support for WPR comes from the American Society of Landscape Architects Wisconsin chapter, dedicated to reimagining the design of outdoor spaces for the well-being of all. Examples at wiasla.com.
Thanks so much for listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Larry Mueller. And we're switching gears a little bit. We're still going to talk about Native Americans, but we're switching to a time back in more, for the most part, World War II area, and talk to one of the authors of a book called Code Talker, the first and only memoir by one of the original Navajo code talkers of World War II. Judith Sheese Avila, our guest today, she's the co-author of Code Talker, and she joins us from the studios of KANW in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Judith, are you there?
I'm here, Larry.
Ah, wonderful. It's great to hear your voice, and thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Really enjoyed your book.
I mean, thank you.
it is a fascinating story of the Navajo code talkers. And you know what? There may be people listening saying, "What in the heck was a Navajo code talker?" and maybe just very briefly to begin with, explain what that term, who those people were, and then we'll back up and talk about the book.
Certainly, the Code Talkers were a group of young Navajo men initially, who were brought into the Marines for a special project. They didn't know what that project was going to be, but there were 30 young men, and they went into the Marines. They went through basic training, and after basic, they were pulled aside and told that the Marines were having terrible problems with the Japanese in the Pacific, breaking every one of their codes, and that they needed a new code, and they wanted to try a code that was based on both English and Navajo. And these 30 men, actually, it kind of got honed down to 29 because one man disappeared and no one knows quite what happened to him. But those 29 men then developed a code that became the only unbroken code in modern warfare. It was a doubly encrypted code based on both English and Navajo.
That was absolutely amazing. How did you become interested in the history of the code talkers?
You know, I was just really lucky that I heard from a friend of a friend that he had met this fascinating guy named Chester Nez, and did I know anyone who might be interested in writing about him? And I jumped at the chance. Mm-hmm. I called Chester's family, and I met with him and his son Mike, and we sat down over lunch and talked for several hours, and I said to them when we were done, you know, I don't think this is an article. I really think this is a book. Chester's life, Chester Nez, was so fascinating. And I felt it was something that the American public would want to know about and that they needed to know about.
Well, I think you're right there. I think you're absolutely right there. And this is a real stirring account. And so many ways, kind of sad for me to hear about how Chester's life began and through the first portion of his life. It's really kind of sad for me. I don't know how it was for you.
Yeah, it was a tough life. I especially found the livestock massacre to be sad.
It's hard to read.
Yeah, it was very hard to write. I cried the whole time I wrote about that.
Yeah.
But it was a tough life. But if his life hadn't been tough, I don't think he would have been able to be the kind of person who was so calm under pressure that he could virtually become a coding machine in the midst of a battle. And the other young men had similarly tough lives, the boarding school, being scared all the time they were going to do something wrong and get hit or kicked by one of the matrons. The livestock massacre that I'm not sure whether our listeners know about. I can say more on that if you want me to. Mm-hmm. But their early tough years really made them tough. And it made them the kind of people who could stay calm under pressure, which I think was huge for the job they did for us in World War II in the Pacific.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, maybe you could, and by the way, I want to give our listeners a chance to join in as they listen. And you may be familiar as you listen with the Navajo Code Talkers work. What would you like to know about them or about that time period? I'd certainly love to hear from you at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@WPR.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Maybe you could describe for us they call it the checkerboard area. This is New Mexico, where Chester grew up. What was life like there?
The checkerboard area was an area just outside the boundaries of the Navajo Nation, the Navajo Reservation. It was an area that was owned by a diverse ownership. Some people were Hispanic, some were Anglo, and some were Navajos. And the portions owned by the Navajo people were considered to be part of the reservation proper, even though they were separated by a small distance. It was a tough lifestyle. Chester started herding his grandmother's sheep when he was only 5. I don't think he knew it was a tough lifestyle, though. He was out in beautiful country. He was free to run around all day with the sheep. Oftentimes, he said they walked 17 to 20 miles in a day. He was in really good shape, and he was doing something that he knew helped his family. He lived with his grandmother and his father because his mother died when he was only about 3. And after that, he sometimes felt like he might be a bit of a burden to his grandmother, but he knew that by helping to herd the sheep, he was contributing, and that always made him feel good. But it was rough. They were out day and night, winter, spring, summer, and fall. And until he was 10, they didn't even have a real secure dwelling. When he was 10, they built a hogan, which is a pretty solid little house made out of logs and mud. Mm-hmm. Before that, they only had something that they called a summer house, but they lived in it all year round, and it was made out of tree branches, and they'd build a fire to stay warm. But it was not a secure, warm dwelling at all.
No, that's for sure. It was a pain. It was painful to read about having to live in wintertime, for sure.
Yes.
Paul in Ettrick has a question for you. Hi, Paul.
Well, I don't really have a question so much as I just wanted to say in World War One, though they weren't Navajo, it was Choctaw, I believe, were used as code talkers in World War One, and the code talkers went on to serve in World War Two and even the early parts of Vietnam. And I think one reason they're not so well known is they weren't actually, the public wasn't actually made aware of them, I don't think, until around 1968 when they were disbanded in Vietnam and everything was declassified.
You're right. The code talkers were asked not to talk about their contribution in World War II. At least Chester's group of Navajo code talkers were asked not to talk about what they had done. So for 23 years, they kept silent about what they had accomplished. And it was 1968 when it was released from secrecy. And you're also right about the Choctaws in World War One. I believe they used their language as a code, which is a little different from what the Navajo code talkers did. But the same kind of idea, yes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we're certainly going to get into more of that. But Chester, you know, I think about boarding school. You think, oh, it's a fancy place and all this. But the boarding schools that the Native Americans like Chester went to were designed to disconnect them from their culture, from their religion, and their language. So you comment on that experience.
Yes, that was a very disturbing experience for Chester because the white people who ran the boarding schools were Christian and specifically Catholic at the school he went for the longest period. And he was actually an altar boy for a while, which the religion he was practicing at boarding school was totally at odds with his religion at home, where there were multiple gods and all kinds of stories of creation, some of them quite similar to the Catholic, some of them very different. And also the kids were punished if they spoke their native Navajo language. And the fact that they were severely punished for speaking Navajo was something that led them to feel real shock when they were told to develop a code using Navajo. They could hardly believe their ears. And at first they thought that the Marines were kidding, but they were deadly serious. They wanted that code and they needed that code. And it turned out to be a great thing.
And, of course, the fact that they were forced to learn proper English, and otherwise they wouldn't have been code talkers.
You're right. They needed to know English and Navajo both perfectly because the code was based on both. And, of course, when they'd receive a transmission and it would be written in English, and then they would be a coding machine. They would read it in English but say it out loud in the Navajo code over the radio. And then, of course, the person at the other end had to receive it in Navajo and be able to immediately translate it into English. So they needed to speak perfect English.
All the while, people were bombing them and shooting at them.
Yeah, it was not an easy task. It really wasn't, but eventually they became so well known for having such accuracy that in some assaults, the code talkers were the only people used for transmissions. Like on Iwo Jima, when they were storming the beaches, the code talkers were used to transmit exclusively, and in Peleliu as well. And they were used extensively all throughout the Pacific.
And we're going to stop right there for a minute, and we'll come back and talk with Judith. She's Avila about her book, Code Talkers. Stay with us. There are many stories of bravery and heroism from World War II, but one of the most fascinating and important efforts was kept top secret for decades after the war ended. That's involved some of the poorest of Americans and Native Americans using their tribal language to serve a country that tried to stamp out their culture. That makes it all the more compelling story, I think. And Chester Nez, one of the original code talkers, spoke extensively with Judith Shees Avila. And together they wrote Code Talker, the first and only memoir by one of the original Navajo code talkers of World War II. And Judith joins us from the studios of KANW in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Judith, thanks again so much for spending time with us today. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you, Larry. I love talking about the code talkers.
Well, they were sure an interesting bunch. They lived a very, very hard life. Went to boarding school where they were again. They were trying to disconnect them from their culture, their native culture, and yet they turned around and enlisted in the war. How and why did Chester enlist?
Well, you know. During the time he grew up, young men were raised as warriors. And I learned from Chester that a warrior is not a warlike person the way you might think. A warrior is someone who protects both the land and the people he loves. They are protectors. And so when our country was bombed in Pearl Harbor by the Japanese back in December of 1941, Chester knew he was going to join the battle.
And And frankly, there were several other and good friends of his, I think, or at least that joined and were excellent Marines.
Yes, actually, there were no problems with any of the original Code Talkers as far as going through basic training was concerned. They thought it was hard work, but it really wasn't any harder than their life had been on the reservation. So all of the physical activity was tough, but certainly doable. I think the hardest thing for a lot of the young men was learning to swim and having to jump off a 30-foot-high platform because they were desert people, and they really hadn't spent much time around water. But they did well, and the Marines really appreciated them, so that made them feel good.
Connie in Arcadia has a question for you, so let's go to Connie. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. My question has to do with the Navajo language. I'd be curious, what do you know about its origins? And it's obviously not Indo-European.
It's a fascinating language. Actually, Judith does a nice job somewhere around the middle of the book, as I remember, of explaining. It's a very interesting language and a difficult one, I think, for somebody who just doesn't grow up in it to learn it.
It is. And the roots of the language are Athabascan. It's related to all other Athabascan languages, among them Apache. And it's completely different from English or the Romance languages in the way it's structured. The verbs are especially complex. If you're going to, for instance, pick something up, if you pick up a handful of mud, you use one word because of the texture of what you are picking up. If you pick up a stick that is totally different from mud in texture and in all characteristics, you use a different verb. The verbs of the language are totally connected to the life that the Navajos led and how small differences in nature could be big differences for them because they were so dependent upon nature. So the language is extremely complex, and there are different forms if one person is performing an activity from two people and a different form again for more than two people performing that same activity. It's very complex. It's tonal in nature. There are four tones, and it also uses glottal stops. And it's I've tried to learn some Navajo words, and I'm terrible at it. And I've been pretty good at learning other languages, but Navajo just did not come naturally to me at all.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Connie, for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, by the way, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions or comments. Or email us at talk@WPR.org as we talk with Judith Sheese Avila, who is co-author of Code Talker, the first and only memoir by one of the original Navajo Code Talkers of World War II. Chester Nez was the other author of the book and was a Code Talker and pretty old guy when you talked. Yeah, you know, I mean, that's a long time ago.
Yeah, he's 91 now, and at the time I met him, it was almost 6 years ago, and he is just an amazing man. He remembers so much about the war. He remembers such rich detail, and he's so excited about people knowing how his Navajo people helped their country. I think that's the primary reason he wanted to work on the book with me. I thought about, you know, money and sales and things like that, as well as the topic, which is very important. But Chester just zeroed in on having people know how his Navajo people helped their country. And it's extremely important to him. And he's so pleased that the book is doing well and that people are enjoying it.
Oh, I was going to ask you the book. I was hoping that the book was doing well because we certainly want a lot of people to read this.
Yes, it is doing well. It's not on the New York Times bestseller list or anything yet.
Mm-hmm.
But it's doing extremely well. I've heard from people all over the world who have read it and have been grateful that the story's been told. And we're even going to visit Wisconsin in March. We're going to be up at Northland College. So we're looking forward to that. Yeah.
Well, you'll have to call and let me know ahead of time. Maybe we can have you back.
Oh, that'd be fun.
Yeah, it would be fun to have you. Yeah, and we can then we can sort of promote your visit up at Northland as well at the same time.
Oh, that sounds great.
And I want to talk a little bit more about this code, because the Navajo, the code talkers, they figured the code out themselves. The Marines said, figure it out yourself.
Yes.
And so explain what they came up with.
Well, for a while, they sat and just talked. In Navajo life, there's a lot of cooperation. A lot of the things that are required, like sheep herding, require the cooperation of many people. And this is the way they work. They work by cooperating with each other. So they discussed the whole thing for a while. And then one of the men who had been in ROTC in high school said, you know, what you do with a code is you start with the alphabet. So they decided they would use Navajo words that were very distinct on the radio so they wouldn't get confused, and words that were part of their everyday life. But they didn't want to go directly from the English alphabet to the Navajo word. They decided to make it more complex by going first to an English word and then translating that into Navajo. So, for instance, the letter A was ant, the English word ant, like the bug. And that in Navajo is wolachi. So when they said wolachi, they meant A. And they developed words like that for all of the alphabet, and then they worked with a few other Navajo Marines who helped them out with ranks and equipment and things they weren't familiar with yet because they'd just gone into the Marines. And they developed words that were logical from their lifestyle for various pieces of equipment. For instance, the fighter plane was a hummingbird. And if you've seen hummingbirds, you know they're extremely maneuverable, like a fighter plane. Yeah. And they're also pretty vicious.
Yeah.
The dominant hummingbird does not want the other hummingbirds going to the feeder. So that was a perfect choice of words. And a transport plane became an eagle, atsa. A hand grenade became a potato because of its shape. And a battleship, a whale. And so on. So they made the words easy to remember by making them connect to their lives and connect to the equipment they were describing.
And they practiced and practiced and practiced. Imagine how hard it must have been, because they had to, as you say in your book, it had to be just second nature with them. You couldn't say the word and then on the other end the person would say, okay, that's the word, the English word ant, that's the A. They had to, when they heard the Navajo word, they had to immediately know that's a letter A.
You're right, Larry, they did. There was no time to waste. I mean, these codes, many of the transmissions were extremely important and had to be transmitted immediately because they had to do with artillery and where the enemy was located and so on. And they didn't want any mistakes, and they needed to have that information immediately. And it turned out the code was so much better than the shackle code the Marines had been using. I think it was something like they were given a test initially.
Yeah.
And the shackle code, the men transmitting in shackle code, took 2 hours to transmit and receive results from the message they transmitted. And the Navajos took something like 2 minutes and 30 seconds.
2.5 minutes.
It was, yeah.
Unbelievable.
It was incredible. And they did practice and practice and practice. Chester said they never quit practicing.
Yeah. And they were. Jason wondered if they were drafted for that task or were they enlisted by choice. And I think they enlisted by choice in all cases.
They did. Yes, they volunteered. They were not told what the task was going to be. I think probably the Marines wanted to make sure that they made it through basic training before they let anyone know what the task was because of the top secret mission. You know, they didn't want people who failed out of basic to know about the mission.
Eric in Green Bay, thanks for calling. Hello.
Hello. My question was, were the Japanese aware that the Navajo language was being used during the war, and did they actively pursue the code talkers and consider them to be a prized possession if they were to capture one?
Yes, the Japanese eventually figured out that Navajo was being used, or at least they thought it was being used. They never were able to capture an actual Navajo code talker, but they did capture other Navajos and tortured them, trying to make them figure out the code. But, of course, the code was complex enough so that other Navajos could not break it either, even if they tried.
Hmm.
Okay.
So there you have it. And, in fact, this was interesting. At one point, finally, the Marines realized, those out in the battlefield, realized the importance of these guys and Judith, talk about, they actually were assigned people to guard them.
Yeah, they were. For anyone who saw that movie, Wind Talkers, that was made back in, I think it was released in 2001, that was pretty accurate as far as the bodyguards went. The men were assigned bodyguards. They weren't told that they were bodyguards. Chester thought the two men who kind of stuck close to him were good friends. And they were good friends, too, but they all had each other's back. There was never an instance, however, of a bodyguard having to shoot his Navajo man that he guarded, as in the movie, if you've seen that. There's a big drama around that.
Oh, there was. Okay.
Yeah.
There you go, Eric. Yes. Thank you very much for calling. Penny in Sheboygan, hello to you.
Hello. Yeah, a few years ago, Green Bay's public TV station had a documentary on the code talkers, and I'm wondering how do I put it? Is there going to be like an update? You know, in that the life after being a code breaker, what happened to them? After, you know, World War II was over and, you know.
Mm-hmm. And that actually is part a good part of, a bigger part of Judith's book. As at least, yeah, what happened to Chester.
I do talk about what happened to Chester. And it's interesting you asked that, Penny, because Penguin, seeing how well the book was doing, asked Chester and me to write a second book, just a little short 50-pager that will only be sold as an ebook, but they wanted updates on what happened to some of the code talkers and what Chester's life was like after his book was released. So we've completed that little book, and it's going to be available as an ebook sometime this month or next month, I think. Many of the men who came back felt sure that they would be treated and accepted in mainstream America because they were so well treated and accepted as Marines. And unfortunately, they found out that it was difficult to get a job. The economy wasn't great on the Navajo Nation anymore because most of the sheep had been killed by the government because of overgrazing. So they had a really rough time, a lot of the men did, and at the same time, they were not allowed in a job interview, for instance, to tell the person interviewing them what they had already accomplished by being code talkers, because that was secret. So, unfortunately, quite a few of those men died within just a few years of getting home from the war.
That was very sad, because you would think if you'd been able to talk about your experience Anybody interviewing you for a job would know what a diligent worker you were. And,
exactly.
And, yeah. You know, how committed and so forth. So that really was too bad. And actually, the guys, the code talkers, never got off. Whenever there would be a break, they were never allowed to take a break, were they?
That's right. With Chester's group, specifically the first group of code talkers to go into battle, they recognized so soon how important this code was that when the 1st Marine Division left Guadalcanal for R&R, and that was the division Chester was assigned to, the 2nd Marine Division came in, and he was told he would need to stay because they would need him. And when the 2nd Marine Division left, he again was told he needed to stay because the 3rd Marines were coming in. Now, I believe the code talkers who followed his group, there were about 400 to 420 men who used the code that Chester and his group developed and who also enhanced the code. They did get to go to R&R because the numbers were better distributed at that point. But initially, there were so few men, just the 29, and only 27 went into battle. Two stayed home to train the upcoming code talkers. So initially, it was tough. They didn't get to leave. They were in the battle, day after day, month after month.
And they were in the thick of the fighting in the Pacific. Tell us, is there a story or two that stands out to you?
You know, one that stands out to me is Peleliu. Peleliu was by many analysts considered the bloodiest battle of World War II. Statistically, I think more people died there than in any other battle, although before learning of Peleliu, I always thought Iwo Jima was that battle. But when Chester landed on Peleliu, it was a volcanic island with lots of coral around the island, and he was dropped off quite a ways from the shore. He said it took him and Roy Begay and Roy Noda and Francis Sinigini, all his partners, it took them about 45 minutes to get to shore. And he said one thing that he noticed was lots of American currency floating in the water as they waded into shore. And I said to him, well, did you pick it up? And he said, no, that was currency from people's poker winnings, and that was currency from men who had died. No one touched that money. We were fighting. We had to get into shore. We didn't even think about picking it up. And, you know, just that image has stuck with me. There are so many images, but that one has stuck with me, the men wading through American currency to go to war and possibly die.
Yeah, and you recount some pretty hair-raising. I mean, they had to be in the thick of it in order to be effective.
That's right. They were at the front lines, not directly in the front. The riflemen were in the the front, but the code talkers followed close behind them. I'm a little hoarse here.
No, that's all right. Go ahead. Clear.
Followed close behind them. Okay, just.
And I should just mention that as we're talking here, somebody asked, well, how is Judith's name spelled? Judith Sheese Avila is our guest here, and her name is spelled S-C-H-I-E-S-S, S-C-H-I-E-S-S, and Avila is A-V-I-L-A. And if you go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, you're going to find a link to the book. And a link to her. I'm sorry, go ahead, Judith.
Oh, thank you, Larry. Let's see, where were we?
I forgot.
We were talking about the things in war that so impressed us and Chester's various scrapes. He did get captured by American military, the Army, who thought he was wearing a Marine's uniform but was actually Japanese. And he had a .45 held to his head and was nearly shot. So there were quite a few scrapes the Code Talkers went through of that nature.
Judith, it is, it's been a real pleasure talking with you today. Your book is just fascinating and so well written. I want to thank you so much for being with us and sharing with it.
Larry, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure for me, too.
Our guest today, Judith Sheese Avila, who wrote the book Code Talker, a co-author of Code Talker. She joined us today from KANW in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And it's great to have her along, and also great to learn more about Chester Nez and the Navajo Code Talkers. Thank you for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.